Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Welcome, my wonderful, grand, worldwide audience, to what I think is going to be the four most important shows in a row I've done. Doing something very different for you than I've done before. I'm going to have one guest on 4 weeks in a row to introduce you. Some of you know of him, some don't, to introduce you to the most courageous, outstanding researcher in the field of medicine today, who has recent years, turned his attention to psychiatry and has written two of the most important books in our field. He's talking to us from Denmark, and his name is Peter C. Gotze. His last name is spelled G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E. I've had the honor and the pleasure of, on a couple of occasions, inviting Peter to conferences where I was involved in the planning to speak. And he is the most scientific and yet impassioned, honorable, and honest speaker I've heard in our field of psychology, psychiatry, I suspect in all of medicine. I admire this man immensely. His two latest books are Deadly Medicine and Organized Crime, in which he compares the relationship of the medical establishment to the pharmaceutical industry, compares it to a mafia, and in a similar and in-depth fashion, his second most recent book is Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Peter Gotze, Dr. Gotze, is a founder in the Cochrane Collaboration out of Copenhagen, which peer reviews the peer-reviewed literature, but does it honestly and objectively and writes evaluations on specific medical issues. I think he will tell you that he's never seen such bad literature or such resistance to the truth as when he began to focus his attention on psychiatry. Today we're going to focus in part at least on the remarkably different ways in which psychiatrists view what's happening to the patients and how the patients view it, and indeed often how the family, the therapist, and the entire rest of the world views it. Peter, are you there?
Yes, Peter. Thank you for your introduction.
Would you like to tell the folks a little about how you became a person who devotes his critical intelligence to looking at research?
Yes, that happened many years ago when I took an education as a biologist. And when I had finished that, I didn't know what to do. And then my grandfather, who was a general practitioner, a family doctor, he told me I could go into the drug industry. So I did that. And it didn't take me long before I realized that what was happening there was dishonest. And that was both in research and particularly in marketing. So I felt I needed to get out of there. So I started studying medicine, and when I had qualified, I left the drug industry. So I know from the inside how the drug industry operates. So that's how I came into research. It was actually from the right, from the start, the bad side of research, research that was unreliable and that was sometimes deliberately distorted to give that company a marketing advantage.
And then how did you end up developing the Corcoran collaboration? Tell the folks about it, what it does, and then yeah, how you got into the psychiatric aspect of it.
The Corcoran collaboration was because I defended a thesis about critically reviewing trials and making statistical analysis of many trials of the same disease and with the same drug, which is called a meta-analysis. So I did a pretty statistical thesis, and then the Corcoran collaboration came along, which was also about reviewing trials of the same treatment in the same kind of patients, and then adding it all up after having looked at that critically. So it was pretty natural. I became one of the founders of the Corcoran collaboration. And then I left clinical work almost 20 years ago to be a full-time researcher. And much of my life I have been drawn into areas of controversy, not because I wanted to, but somehow controversies tend to look me up. And that also happened with psychiatry because a person I knew wanted to do a PhD with me, and she came with a very good idea. She said, is history repeating itself? I want to compare the old-fashioned nerve pills, the so-called benzodiazepines or mother's little helper, with the newer antidepressant drugs to see if we learn something from history or if we don't learn anything from history. So she started working with me, and I was flabbergasted when I found out what happens in psychiatry. First of all, she found out that people become dependent on antidepressant drugs just like they do on nerve pills, the benzodiazepines, and the abstinence symptoms are very much the same. And at the same time, the psychiatrist denied generally that antidepressants lead to dependence. And this was totally against the science. And she actually also had difficulty defending her PhD. She did a couple of more studies that were also interesting because her results were so unpopular, but they were correct. And since then, I have done a lot of research in psychiatry. Right now, I have 4 PhD students who all work with psychiatric drugs.
And you do this at the university or at an institute?
I do this work at the Nordic Cochrane Center, which I started at the same time as the Cochrane collaboration started internationally. So my center is 23 years old, and I'm on government funding, which enables me to do things I think are very important so that I can do some research without having to apply for funding, which is a fantastic system because sometimes people just don't understand how important your ideas are before you have actually done the research and can show to them how important it was. So that has helped me to do some very important research that we have this basic funding where I can do what I want.
We don't have a single place like that in the U.S., I don't think.
Yeah,
your funding would get cut off here as soon as you'd written one of your books.
Pardon?
Your funding would get cut off if you were in the U.S. as soon as you wrote your two books, your two most recent books. And
I understand how tough it can be, and I think it's the wrong system. You really should give people who have good ideas an opportunity to actually follow their good ideas without always using a lot of their time on funding application and competing with other people. So you're right that countries are also different in terms of how difficult or easy it is to do things like I'm doing. And in the United States and in several other countries, I agree with you that the drug industry would probably have been so powerful that an institute like mine would have been closed down.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm so glad that you're there and working and doing all this terrific stuff. When did you first start to look at psychiatry in a critical manner?
That was in 2007 or 2008. And I'm sorry, I have also gotten funding money so that we could do even more research than our government funding allowed us, actually including some money from the United States, funnily enough. We have produced many important results, I feel. I'm sorry, I have an infection.
Oh, golly. Do you want to take a drink of water for a minute?
No, it's fine. But, for example, only 2 months ago, we had collected trials in human volunteers, which can typically be students who want to earn some money for their studies, and then they take a drug and serum levels of that drug are being measured, and some of them take a placebo, and these people are absolutely healthy. They are not psychiatric patients. So we collected these studies, and then we found out that that when you take antidepressant drugs, these healthy adult people actually develop side effects that predispose to suicide and violence. So we could show that these drugs are actually dangerous, not only for children and adolescents, but also for adults. And only last month, we then had data from the European Medicines Agency. And then we could show that when you give an antidepressant drug to middle-aged women who suffer from urinary incontinence, then many more of them develop side effects that activate them and agitate them and actually predispose to suicide and violence than those women who got a placebo. So we have shown this autumn that antidepressant drugs are dangerous for people at all ages and not only for children and adolescents. And I believe these results are very important.
Have you published them yet?
Yes, they have both been published. The study on urinary incontinence was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal on Your Continent just 1 month ago. And actually, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States and the Canadian Drug Agency, they refused to approve this drug for urinary incontinence, but it's approved in Europe.
Wow. And what about the suicidal reactions you were getting? Have you written about that, Peter?
Where they came from?
Yeah, have you written about it?
I published these two reviews with my coworkers, but I don't think I got your question, really.
Oh, okay. And so the information about the antidepressants causing suicidality in essentially psychiatrically normal people. That is in those papers?
Oh, yes. The first one in adults, in volunteers, is published in Journal of Royal Society of Medicine, which is the UK journal, and the most recent one in the Canadian Medical Journal. So it's all out there. And you might be interested in knowing how leading psychiatrists reacted to this research.
Yes.
many of them are on drug industry payroll. And they tried to ridicule our research, like saying, oh, that guy thinks that just people have some nightmares and get agitated or nervous, then they go out and either kill themselves or other people or both. And since we don't see all these suicides and killings, that can't be correct. And I mean, how can you argue in this way? And I will give you an example. We all know that smoking is not healthy for us. Inactivity is not healthy for us. These are risk factors for getting a heart attack and die. So therefore, we tell people stop smoking and exercise. So these are risk factors. We all accept this. And what we have demonstrated in psychiatry is the same. We have demonstrated some side effects that occur when people take antidepressant drugs that are known as being risk factors for suicide and violence. And who decided that? The Food and Drug Administration decided 10 years ago that these are risk factors for suicide and violence and homicide. So it's so sad that leading psychiatrists, they often refuse to see the facts that lie right there in front of their eyes.
They absolutely do. I remember when the antidepressants first came out, I was in Bethesda, Maryland then, now I'm in Ithaca, New York, and I had a very good internist, and he told me that he could tell which patients were taking the new antidepressant. It was Prozac. There were no competitors then, because he said so many of them looked irritable, angry, tense when they came in to the office.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So it was just immediately apparent to him as an internist that this was going on. And at the same time, I lectured at the local general hospital to the psychiatric rounds and talked about these issues, and every doctor there denied it and said these patients just needed more of the drug.
Oh, so, yes.
So we're talking today, we're moving into the general subject today, which is what goes on that psychiatrists and other promoters of these drugs can't see or don't see what's going on. And they also don't have the same view of what the patients perceive. You know, often in clinical trials, folks, the drug gets approved on the basis of what the psychiatrist decides, but the patient doesn't view the drug as improving him. So you'll have a patient checkoff list, and the patients don't find that the drug is helping, but the psychiatrist does. Or in the case of children, maybe the teacher and the psychiatrist do, but the children and the family don't. I mean, this is such a rigged system and such a one-sided system.
Yes. Sorry. I agree completely, and I have also written a good deal about that in my latest book. For example, clinical trials of antidepressant drugs. In these trials, whether they are done in children or in adults, the patients say that these drugs don't work for their depression. It is the psychiatrists that say that the drugs work for the depression. But then we should think about that these drug trials are not adequately blinded. You give a placebo in order to blind whether a person gets active drug or placebo, but these drugs, as you said, have conspicuous side effects, so often the psychiatrists have guessed who gets active drug and who gets placebo, and when they have broken the blinding, they will tend to exaggerate the effect, because it's very subjective to measure the effect on depression. That is done with some scales, and so when you know who got what, you will exaggerate the effect, and then you will say it worked, but the patients tell us that the drugs don't work, so whom should you believe? I'm not in any doubt about whom to believe, and also it's the patients that we are going to treat with drugs, not the psychiatrists.
Well, maybe in some way the psychiatrists are treating themselves with the drugs. They're treating their inability to help people. They're treating their delusions. They're treating their misperceptions by giving the drugs to people. I mean, it's a self-treatment in a way, in a real way it is. I haven't quite ever put it that way. I think I need to invent a term to describe the phenomenon of whereby people give drugs, psychiatric drugs, really to treat their own needs, inadequacies, anxieties, and so on. It's really gotten so bad now that the psychiatrists, well, in general physicians too, it's not just psychiatrists anymore. I think you and I probably agree that we hold psychiatrists mainly responsible among physicians, because they collaborate with the drug companies and psychiatric societies to push these drugs, and with the FDA too, with the agencies in each country to push the drugs. But everybody who can prescribe gives them out, and they give them out now often on the basis of something they plug into a computer, and they can plug in insomnia, and they might get a sedative antidepressant out like trazodone. Or they plug in anxiety and they'll get an antidepressant out. It becomes a matter of the patient speaks a code word or even say fatigue, and they end up on an antidepressant. And in these cases, I think it would be useful to look at it as the doctor treating his or her own inadequacies, own lack of capacity to help. But it is a dreadful situation.
I agree with you. It can be difficult to sit with a patient who feels very badly about life, and it takes time, and you need to take an interest in that person. You need to be a good psychotherapist in order to help that person, and it's much easier just to prescribe a pill. And then everything gets focused on that pill. Next time you see the patient, how is it going? Well, if it's going better, then you will conclude that it's because the pill is working, not thinking about that most people get better anyhow, also if you don't do anything. For example, people with depression. So I agree with you. It's a convenient way of dealing with your own bad conscience that you don't do enough for your patients, perhaps because the hospital you work for don't give you enough time to practice psychotherapy on your patients. So it's not always the doctor's fault. It can also be a system's fault.
It's definitely, in this country, the insurance companies will cover 10 or 15 minutes for med check, and the docs can make a lot more money than doing psychotherapy. The result is doctors, including psychiatrists, are not really trained in psychotherapy anymore. I know young psychiatrists who are becoming interested in my work here in the U.S., surprisingly. There's a few of them. And they don't know what to do. They see what's the matter, but they don't know what to do because they haven't been trained to listen and speak and be helpful to people. So they need to go get training separate from psychiatry in psychotherapy.
Yes. They definitely need to do that. And if we take the most used drug group, which is antidepressant drugs, in psychiatry and in general practice, then not only are these pills used for virtually everything, as you indicated, even insomnia, and if people go through a divorce or go up to a difficult exam and are anxious about it and whatever happens, in half of the cases, the family doctor doesn't even have an approved indication for using an antidepressant drug. So just like my PhD student found out, history is unfortunately repeating itself, because that was exactly how we dealt with the benzodiazepines in the old days. And if we then look at depression, then I have concluded that these drugs don't really work for depression. And I have explained why in my book.
Now, in your book, you mean Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial?
Yeah.
Good. Let's get that word out again. Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial, folks.
Yeah. And for example, not only do the patients say that the drugs don't work for them, but there are no studies that have shown that by taking an antidepressant drug, you come back to work and save your marriage and other social relationships, and you actually do better in society. There are no studies to show this. And actually, it seems that your quality of life probably worsens when you come on an antidepressant drug, because you become less interested in yourself and in other people, and half of people's sex lives get affected by these drugs. And then the most important thing of all for people with depression is to avoid suicides. And I have come to the conclusion that these drugs seem to increase the risk of suicide for everyone, not only children and adolescents, but also middle-aged women and whoever you might think about. And if you look at psychotherapy, there are trials in prevention of suicide, and they actually tell us that psychotherapy can reduce the risk of suicide in people with depression. So we have pills that increase the risk of suicide. We have psychotherapy that decreases the risk of suicide. And what do? We use pills and very little psychotherapy. This is totally insane, and it's harmful for our patients.
It's really harmful for the world. One of the things I like about your work is how much you actually confront the depth of the evil in looking at these collaborative efforts between medicine and the pharmaceutical industry, which I've taken to calling the pharmaceutical empire. I used to call it the psychopharmaceutical complex. It's a little too remote. It's an empire, a pharmaceutical empire that dominates medicine, but also dominates legislative bodies and educational institutions, universities, the media. In the U.S., ever since we got direct-to-consumer advertising, it's practically impossible to get a critique of psychiatric drugs on any of the networks, because they were all so beholden. They're so beholden to the drug industry for their survival.
That's another very, very sad thing that you now talk about. I give interviews in many countries, both in television and to newspapers and weekly magazines and radio and so on. And I can definitely tell you that there is a clear difference between countries. In some countries, they have a pretty free press still, like in Holland, where the journalists are very well educated and where you speak openly about the problems with psychiatric drugs. And then there are other countries, like Sweden, where it until recently was virtually impossible to criticize psychiatry and psychiatric drugs, and the big newspapers didn't want to write about it. So when your science journalist, Bob Whittaker from New York, his famous book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, the Psychiatric Drug Epidemic, when that was translated into Swedish, he visited Sweden and gave some lectures. And the Swedish psychiatrist succeeded to censor completely what he had done. There was absolutely nothing in the media. But for some reason, I cannot really understand. I was more lucky when my psychiatry book became translated into Swedish. So I have given two lectures in Stockholm this autumn, and I have been on a widely seen television channel on Swedish science radio. But yet the two major newspapers in Sweden, they both came and interviewed me. But the journalists were not allowed to publish anything from their bosses back home at the newspaper. We know what censorship means also in our country. Not so much in Denmark, but in Sweden it's pretty bad, I would say.
I'd like to return and explore a little more this concept that was actually your idea to focus some of the show on. And it's just so important for folks to realize that when a psychiatrist looks at a patient, the psychiatrist is not trying to understand the person. That is no longer what's going on, and especially in the U.S., but to a great extent everywhere. The psychiatrist is not trying to find out the life story, your conflicts, what you've been through, if you've been much happier at other times, why you're struggling now with unhappiness in the form of anxiety or guilt or shame or depression or all the various ways we human beings become distressed and unhappy. The psychiatrist is simply looking for code phrases that hook up with certain drugs. I've literally seen people put on antipsych in my legal work, where I get to review lengthy medical records. I've literally seen things like a still tense, two words, still tense, repeated over several years for a patient getting antipsychotic drugs. Still tense. And certainly still depressed or depressed will just be repeated for years. Or bipolar, which has become a favorite. And one of the reasons, or really the main reason bipolar is a favorite, is because between the polar of depression and the pole of mania, you can give any drug. So people who are bipolar get every single drug in the book usually, even though it's well known that in fact most of them a mania from the antidepressants and stimulants is where they got their mania from. So the psychiatrist, when you go to the psychiatrist, for those of you out there who are new to this or naive about this, it's not somebody who's welcoming you as a human being to understand and help you. And this is now filtered down to all the specialties and the general practice of medicine as well. As soon as you say a few words that suggest something emotional is going on, I've seen people drugged for being, quote, too emotional. That's no disorder. That's no disease. If it is a characteristic, it's a very positive one once you learn to manage life better, because it indicates somebody who's sensitive, aware, has a lot of feelings. So it is very dismal out there. It is not about an individual human being now when you go for any kind of psychological, emotional help. Now, there are still psychotherapists out there who will treat you like a human being. Many of them are in our country, U.S., or clinical social workers or clinical psychologists. But they've been so intimidated that if you have an intense emotion, or God forbid you feel like hurting yourself, they're going to refer you to the psychiatrist because they're trained to do that. So there are code words like feeling suicidal or feeling like harming yourself that will get you sent out of the therapy system now into the drug system. Does it work pretty much the same way in Europe, Peter?
Yes, I hear about this all the time. I get very many emails from desperate patients or desperate relatives to patients, and I also sometimes talk to patients when I give public lectures. And it's a very consistent pattern that you have just described. And I can give a few other examples. Many psychiatric drugs have nasty side effects that look like psychiatric disorders. So when a patient gets such side effects, psychiatrists are likely to tell them that now you have a new disorder, instead of focusing on that it might be a side effect of the drug. And in the worst case, patients want to come off a drug because they are aware that this is a side effect, this is not me. And then they just get a higher dose, or the psychiatrist adds another drug on top of the first one, telling the patient, you don't know because you don't have insight in your disease, I know better. And some of these nasty side effects can be psychosis, for example. And if a patient feels that this is not natural, there's something wrong with my drug, with the drug I'm taking, and after the psychiatrist increased the dose last time, I have become very weird and, in fact, psychotic. But then most psychiatrists will think, oh, now the patient is psychotic, so now the patient needs an antipsychotic drug on top of the ADHD medication or the antidepressant drug or whatever it was that actually caused the psychosis as a side effect. So this is one of the things I've learned from your books, Peter, that psychiatrists should never come up with a new diagnosis when a patient is already on one or more psychiatric drugs, because what they see might in many cases be side effects and not a new psychiatric disease. And I have discussed this with the professor in Denmark, whom I think is regarded as the one who knows most about bipolar disorder. And I asked him at the meeting where we both lectured, now, considering that ADHD drugs, they have side effects that are actually very much the same criteria you use for diagnosing bipolar, then how do you know when you have a patient with these symptoms whether it is side effects of the ADHD drug or whether it is a true bipolar disease? And to my big surprise and astonishment, he said, well, I can distinguish between these two. And then I just gave up further discussion. When the symptoms are virtually the same, nobody can distinguish between whether it's a side effect or a new disease. No one. But when...
Peter, are you there? I seem to have lost Peter Gerze. Let me see if I still am on line with my group. They're typing my marvelous engineer. They're going to call him back. Let me tell you again about who we're talking with. We're talking with Peter C. Goetze, G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E. His two books are Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime. That's one book. And the second book is Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Peter and I have come to very similar conclusions, really identical conclusions in most areas about psychiatry. And interestingly enough, although he is a bit younger than me, he is one of my few guests who really didn't come into this realizations from reading my books, but rather on his own, entirely developing his working in Europe and me working here in the U.S., and then are learning about each other, which has been very, very heartwarming to me, because pretty much until Peter, I've been the only medical doctor standing up on these issues in great detail and great depth the way I have been. Bob Whitaker has been writing some wonderful books, but he's a journalist. He's not a physician. The way Peter Goetze is, and some other people have written some pretty good books, but no one's really devoted themselves to an honest exaggeration, an honest examination of the exaggerations that go on in psychiatry and the actual toxic effects of psychiatric drugs. I still don't have Peter back online. PRN is trying to get in touch with him. But I'll keep talking about the issues that we have in common and remind you that this is the first of a four-part series that I'm going to be doing with Peter, and that they will all available online. Did I hear Peter Goetze's voice in the background? Hi, Peter.
I'm terribly sorry. I was my telephone just went away, so I went for another one.
That's fine. I took a few minutes just to tell people more about you, remind them about your books in the four-part series, and also, which I think we could continue on, that you really got into this whole examination of psychiatry wholly independent of me, although I had a number of books out, I think, at the time you began your work. You didn't know about my books. You really came to these such similar conclusions working across the pond without having read Toxic Psychiatry or any of my other books. That's so, isn't it?
It's absolutely so, yes. I came to very similar conclusions as you, but totally independent of you, so it was pretty late, actually, that I started to read your books.
Yes. It was only about a year ago, that I sent you a whole bunch of them. You had seen one or two of them.
I'm telling the
audience how glad I am that you are there, because there aren't any other physicians, scientists, other than you and I, who are really as focused on these issues. There's some other very good people. Tom Moore, I mentioned, of course, Bob Whitaker, Thomas Moore. Tom Moore's been writing good stuff. But there really isn't a physician or a psychiatrist, although there have been a few psychiatrists writing some books, who've gone into it with quite the same ferocity and depth that you and I have.
Well, they are very few, unfortunately. But I hope that more will be coming among the younger psychiatrists. I have talked to several young psychiatrists in training who were desperate because they felt that they could not accept the way psychiatry was, with using far too many drugs and harming patients in that way. For example, one of them told me that she took over her boss's patients, his outpatients, and then she started to taper off the drugs in order for them to become better. And then he became very angry that she was not supposed to change anything that he had decided. So they should just go on taking these drugs forever, it seemed. So she was absolutely desperate and came to see me. And I said, well, psychiatry badly needs people like you. You should not drop off. Lie a little low until you have become boss yourself, and then you can start to revolutionize psychiatry. Keep up your appearances till you're through.
Terrible. You know, that's what Thomas Oss did in the U.S. Once he got tenure, then he wrote The Myth of Mental Illness. Tom has not done what you and I have done, which is confront the atrocities of the drugs, shock treatment, lobotomy, and so on that I've been writing about, and your very heavy involvement in evaluating the meds. But he waited. But, you know, he got just as marginalized afterward. They tried to get him fired even though he had tenure. They just failed. They failed to accomplish it, and then they marginalized him. So I'm not too hopeful about psychiatry being changed from within, because it extrudes, suppresses, tries to harm those within that become critical. I don't know. What do you think about that possibility of change within psychiatry? Do you really think that some courageous young people could make a lot of change within the profession?
I agree with you that there are too few of them. And during their training, they become indoctrinated. They become brainwashed by the older ones. So it is very, very difficult. I just get so happy when I get to know some of these people, and I support them in any way I can. And I do think that more and more people are waking up these days. There is a mounting pressure, which I can also feel from journalists. Journalists are very, very interested in making documentaries on TV and write about these things in newspapers. And I think it is growing, at least in some countries. It is actually becoming better, but of course, much, much too slowly. But there is one little positive thing, that after sales of antidepressants have just gone up and up and up in Denmark, in my country, then around 2011, the sales leveled out. And after that, they actually started to decline, not very much. But in this absurd world, we should rejoice when something goes in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, the only place I know where there's been a sustained drop in drug sales, it's been Australia, where there's been a drop in some regions of Australia in the use of ADHD drugs as a direct result of an assemblyman there named White, whom I've had on the show a couple of times. But it is so hard. One of the things that's happening now, folks, is that the general public is becoming more and more aware of just how bad the situation is. And so are a fair amount of general practitioners. I think people who don't have huge vested interests are becoming more and more aware. And so more and more people are refusing to put their kids on drugs or to take psychiatric drugs. But the industry is so powerful that while this minority of people grows who are saying no to drugs, the number of people captured by the drug companies, literally captured by the drug companies, the pharmaceutical empire and psychiatry medicine, is growing in number. So you have the dissidents growing while the power on the other side also grows. Maybe someday, like the Berlin Wall, it'll just topple down, that people will just stop going along with it, and the power will lose its base. I don't see it happening in psychiatry for a long, 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 long time. But we are getting more and more across to the public here in the U.S. The media in the U.S. here is dead. It's bought. It's gone.
Yeah. Well, that's a global thing, that journalists become fewer and fewer in number because the newspapers want to earn money. And then they take more and more press releases just as they are, without investigating whether they are true or not. They just get published as though they were truthful, and more they come from corporations. So we have a huge democratic problem that is just growing all the time as fewer and fewer journalists work with the issues. It's very sad. But fortunately, we have the internet, and many people, also those who are not journalists, have actually created some very good websites that have an enormous amount of visitors. And we both know Bob Whitaker and Matt in America, his website. It has very many visitors. Bob is a science journalist, but as I said, also, people who are not journalists and not doctors have created websites that help spread another message than the sales pitches from the drug industry.
Yes. I want to remind folks, and I don't know if you know, Peter, I've put together a giant subsection on my website on Bregan.com, which is a tardive dyskinesia resource center, where there's probably more than 150 scientific articles, PDFs, that people can download, and an introductory discussion of tardive dyskinesia that patients, families, lawyers, scientists, physicians can use to get oriented toward this terrible movement disorder, which also often involves emotional and cognitive problems. So I've made that resource available for free to people, along with my electroshock website, which is separate, my ECT Resource Center. So there's a lot of stuff out there for people, and that's just growing hugely. And I just, you know, I think we may see the day where this begins to change what goes on in terms of what people want, what people look for. Human nature is so susceptible to being influenced. Before we finish, I want to mention, we've got about 4 minutes left, the concept of medication spellbinding, which, Peter, you yourself said as we were talking before the show, we should bring in. And that is, you know, why do folks put up with these drugs? Why do they keep taking them even when they sense they're harmful? Well, one explanation, of course, is all the pressure that's put on people by the doctors, all the propaganda on the television and in the magazines from the drug companies. So that's one source. Another source is that the people are suffering and they're seeking relief, they're desperate for relief. But another source is something we see with all psychoactive substances, including alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, and all the psychiatric drugs, which is that people taking them don't have a really good, many people, not all, many people taking them, particularly the people who get hooked on them for years or a lifetime, don't have a good perception of the harm that's being done. So if you look at people who are on benzos for many years or on the antipsychotics for many years or the antidepressants, they don't really realize, unless you really interview them in depth and take a real interest in them, they don't realize how much their quality of life has gone down, how much number they are. And often their family members will realize it but won't associate it with the drug. And similarly with children, parents bring in their kids to me, and only after we start talking do they realize that ever since starting the stimulants, the child doesn't smile anymore, isn't playful anymore, and it really has a sober, somber look about them that is typical of many of the kids on stimulant drugs. Peter, we've got 2 or 3 minutes left. Any remaining thoughts on this general theme of the vast discrepancy between how psychiatrists view things and often how their patients and the rest of the world view things?
Yes, I would actually like to follow up on what you just said, Peter, because when a patient has been under drug influence for quite a while, I think that even the relatives have become accustomed to that. So they have more or less come to see that this is how the patient is. So they don't always realize that this is a drug effect. This is not a natural person.
Boy, that is very, very true. And the other thing, excuse me, the other thing that happens is that under the effect of the drugs, often people, the patient becomes violent at times when they withdraw from them. If they miss the drugs, they have severe drug withdrawal reactions. They end up hospitalized. So the family associates stopping drugs with horrific outcomes, which the doctors have said is the mental illness.
Yes.
It's just over and over again. And, you know, a really important concept is that I'm old enough now that I remember a time in psychiatry when we expected everybody to get better. And if somebody had an acute catastrophic reaction on a drug, we often suspected the drug. We didn't want people on drugs for the rest of their lives. We were not taken over by the need of the pharmaceutical industry to keep people taking their products forever. We actually thought patients got better. Your modern psychiatrist is and other druggers, other prescribers, is completely bamboozled and believes that if you start out with anxiety, you come to the doctor with anxiety or insomnia, you often turn out to be psychotic and manic and need hospitalization. No, that's not the normal course of people who come to doctors having difficulty sleeping or having anxiety. It's a product of the psychiatric system, the drugging and the locking up. Again, folks, we're talking with Peter Goetze, G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E from Denmark. You can find him on the web. His books are Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime, and then Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. He'll be on again with us next week. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you to you too, Peter.